Hi, I'm Greg Menalcock.
Hi, Greg.
And, wow, this is kind of a treat, and I'm also a little anxious about it. But anyway, I haven't qualified in a little while, so it's good that I was asked to speak, and thank you, guys, for asking me to speak tonight. I'm visiting here in Montreal on vacation from New York, which is where New York is where I live, and New York is also where I bottomed out and got sober. But let me tell you a little bit about my background. I was born in Massachusetts. I grew up there about an hour west of Boston. My parents both came from New York State and met in college out in the western part of New York State, Alfred University, actually. It's my mother's 50th anniversary from college, so it's a while back. They were both socialized in the 50s around that whole cocktail culture thing. So I was brought up around a lot of cocktails and get-togethers where there was drinking. And my first drink probably was in connection with one of those cocktail parties where I was making a drink for someone. And I don't know if people do that nowadays, but I would have been like maybe 7 or 8 years old or maybe a little older making drinks for my parents' friends. And that's probably where I had my first sip of whiskey or something. I can remember one of the drinks. It was like rye and ginger, sipping that, and just remember it being very bitter and why would anyone want to drink that. So I had a sweet tooth as a kid, and my first addiction probably before alcohol would have been probably to cookies or Fig Newtons. I used to take a whole sleeve of Fig Newtons and I'd start eating them, and then I would sort of hide them away, and it became sort of a running joke with my family that if they heard the crinkling of the wrapper that they knew I was off of the cookies. But I was kind of a good little boy otherwise that way, and tried, maybe not a straight A student, but close to it, and tried to do the right thing. And so I delayed my actual alcohol consumption, drinking, whatever, until probably when I came of age and around 18. It was the drinking age at that time in Massachusetts. As soon as that happened, I was all bets were off, and I was not only buying liquor for myself, I was buying liquor for anyone who wanted me to buy liquor, including freshmen and sophomores in high school and whoever, kids who would drink brandy before class. And it was very socially accepted in my hometown, and back in that era, this was in the 70s, to just, get a six-pack of beer or a case of beer and just drive around drinking. We used to go, I don't know if they still have drive-ins or up here, if they have drive-ins up here, but they did down there. But we had two drive-ins in my hometown, and that was like a typical get-together for a bunch of friends, and I would be like, take a whole case of beer and go. First we'd play poker, get drunk playing poker, go off to the drive-in, and I'd barely even remember half the movies and just get really drunk off our ass, and we wouldn't think anything of driving drunk. And amazingly, none of us ever were, that I know of anyway, were killed drinking and driving, although I know other classmates who that something happened like that. Let's see, and then speeding up a bit, I also, growing up as a kid, I knew that I was different and couldn't quite come to grips with what exactly was going on with me, and had a lot of trouble interacting with girls in high school, and had crushes on guys, and I just didn't know what was going on with me. And it was kind of a long struggle for me, and had to do a lot with my early drinking, was dealing with those sort of issues. And especially in college, the first time I went off to drink beer with a bunch of friends, just couldn't stop drinking the beer. We had pitchers, and I just wanted to keep up with the so-called frat guys or sports guys or whatever. And I went to college in Virginia, William Mary, and down south. And it's the same era when the drinking age was lower. They had a pub actually on campus for people who were in school there to drink. And that's where I where that happened, and I just remember drinking so much that I threw up on somebody and just slept through the whole next day. And the rest of college was like that, pretty much studying really hard during the week and then binge drinking on the weekends. And especially picked up after my major drug use in college with pot was my second semester of college freshman year, because I had made a pass on my freshman roommate, and they this was before a lot of things were before gay rights were a big thing and before colleges were more open to it, and I was exiled off campus, and just my feelings of shame and all that, I didn't tell my parents or anything, and the way I dealt with that feeling was to just to like suppress it and get really drunk whenever I had the opportunity, to get really high, and my grades suffered, and eventually though, I wound up I guess I got into a German house. I was in a German house the last 3 years of college, and then during that period I wound up falling in love with my best friend and following him to law school. So after college, I went to law school for about 3 years in Pennsylvania, and they're not just dealing with gay feelings, because I didn't come out until after law school, but also the stress of studying and studying hard and just long hours in the library and all of that, and dealing with tests and all that stuff. I just it got worse and worse, and I wound up after the first year of law school, I couldn't find a job, and the way I dealt with that and with stress and everything else was just to get really drunk, and I tried to fit in with straight kids in college, and by doing that, I would go to these parties and just get really, really drunk and make a fool of myself, and for whatever reason, that got me accepted into this law school drinking fraternity thing. And then, of course, let's see, after law school, I wound up in the Philadelphia area, and that's actually where I came out, and before that, I had been drinking so much and having the worst hangovers that I thought that one solution to that would be to come out as being gay, and it didn't really, I guess at the time, it kind of eased things off, because my version of coming out was to go out to a bar every night, gay bar in Philadelphia, and I wound up meeting someone after about 2 weeks, and we wound up going out together, and my drinking sort of moderated after a while, and that was a pattern that followed. For the next while or so, I had about 7 years, a little over 7 years, clean and sober since March 7th of 2000, and the pattern over the period of time from about 1985 on to 2000 was that I was sort of a serial monogamist for a while. I would have relationships, and the way I would deal with relationship problems and things like that was, instead of confronting the issue head on, or even going to therapy about it, or even when I was going to therapy, would be to escape by drinking. And I also, with my job, the same thing, the stress with work, whatever, the way to deal with that was to go out and drink, after work. It became more of a regular ritual instead of just weekends. So it would be every night of the week kind of thing, like stopping off at the bar before I went home. And then I didn't. One fortunate thing in Philadelphia was I didn't drive as much, so I didn't have to worry as much about the drinking and driving. But that's eventually what brought me into the rooms, because I had a period from, it seems like a shorter period now, but back then, 97 to say 2000, I had maybe a series of two or three DUIs, DWAIs, you name it, I had it. was arrested in Philadelphia. I remember one time now, I went to an after-hours bar, and just was doing shots after being out at the bar, and I thought that I was okay to drive, and instead I wound up, I thought I was steering the car, and the car slammed into a van full of people, and that was parked, and spent the night in the roundhouse in Philadelphia. I remember just being really humiliated, because they do your mugshot and all that stuff and fingerprints when that happens. But that didn't stop me. I thought, well, I didn't get charged, and so because I wasn't charged, it must have been my first time they let me off. I thought, well, I got off that time, so I just won't go to that place and do shots anymore. But the same sort of thing happened again. I would be out feeling really good and just, you know, I'd get in a situation where I was driving and I got stopped again by the police. And then the enforcement of drunk driving got stricter in New York, and by then I was living in northern New York. I had lost my job in the Philly area and had moved up to northern Jersey and was commuting into the city, into New York, by car to drive to drink on the weekends. And this was some sort of fundraiser. It was a fundraiser. And so it was all you can drink for like 4 or 5 hours or whatever. And I just kept drinking and wound up meeting up with some people, and they bought drinks for me. And then I thought that I could, I thought that by eating pizza, a couple slices of pizza, that would, you know, absorb the alcohol. It didn't absorb the alcohol, obviously. I got stopped by the police, maybe 2 blocks from where I was driving from, and I got very confrontational with them. I said, the only reason you stopped me is because I'm gay, and said some other thing to him, like, you know, what, he wanted to smell my breath, and I said, what do you want to do, kiss me? And it was sort of a stupid thing to say at the time. But anyway, so I got put in jail for 39 hours and was still wearing my club clothes, like all black and stinking of vodka. In fact, they even said that, you know, when I was in the police car, that I stank. And then I was, at the time, I was supposed to go and appear at a drunken disorderly hearing because I had gotten into an altercation in the subway with someone, with the PATH police, the Transit Authority police. And I was supposed to appear at that hearing, and coincidentally, the Tuesday that I got out of prison. So I went like right from that to the hearing. And the attorney that I had at the time said, you know, he was questioning me about my timing of my drinking and just my history of drinking. And he said, you know, you really should consider AA. And my employer also, because I couldn't get a hold of them, was wondering what was going on. They were ready to fire me. And they pretty much did the same thing. And so I figured the jig was up. So my first meeting was on a Tuesday when I got out of that jail cell on March 7th, 2000. And my first meeting was in the East Village in Manhattan at a predominantly gay meeting called East Village. And I just remember being terrified because the room was packed, probably about this size, but full of people. And sat in the back row and didn't know the soul, and met someone though at the first meeting that was, you know, doing 12-step work, so to speak. And shortly after that, I met my first sponsor at that meeting and was going to a meeting. I didn't realize at first that they suggest in the New York area that you do 90 meetings in 90 days to get sober, and that's what I wound up doing. Pretty much followed his suggestions the first year or two. He was very, he had gotten sober in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, or that area, which is one of the founding areas of AA was in Ohio in the States. And so he had kind of a strict, they have this expression in New York, step Nazi, so to speak. But, you know, I took his suggestions. They're one of the suggestions, and it's not even in the book, so to speak, was no relationship in the first year, no major changes in the first year, no sex in the first 90 days, just anything that would take, and the idea behind it was anything that would take the focus away from your sobriety, which is your first priority. I got a commitment pretty early on, doing coffee at meetings. It's been pretty much a regular part of my sobriety, part of my program is I've always had a commitment. Right now I'm the Friday progress and sobriety chair for Ninth Avenue at the seminary in Chelsea in New York, and that ends the end of this month, and then I have a new one coming up. I'm the step chair for the Ninth Avenue group at a different location at Holy Apostles in Manhattan. Let's see, I've always tried, initially, I would say maybe my first 5 years, one of the keys was making a meeting every day. I haven't been able to do that as much lately, and so hence I've been sort of crazy from a lot of work-related stress. Being a lawyer, I'm still a lawyer and still working in a firm. I have a lot of cases with deadlines and pressure and a very demanding boss, and she pushes my buttons. And but she also knows that I'm sober, which is good, and she knows that I'm gay, and I'm open to her about all of that. And so she gives me some room, and one of these occasions is being able to get away this weekend and go. And she didn't say, it used to be in our relationship with my boss that one of the things I've learned to develop over the course of my sobriety is to set boundaries. And it used to be that there weren't boundaries there, and I would just do whatever she said. And now I've learned that I need to set those boundaries and know when things are getting so bad that it's either I pick up a drink or I, take a vacation, or I know when those usually tend to know when that's happening. And another thing I have learned through sobriety and what I'm doing here now is when I go away, even on vacation, whether it's vacation, work, whatever, to try to make meetings, even if it's not a meeting a day, to make a meeting at least one time when I'm away in another city. And I had a huge case this year that started in February where I was going out of town taking testimony from people. And I've made meetings in, I would say, just about every city I've been to. Houston, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, you name it, Boston. But that really tends to keep me sober when I'm away, because that was part of my drinking history, was when I was doing work out of town and just in a city by myself. Obviously, one of the things I would do was go exploring and go to, check out the local gay bars or whatever, and just get really blitzed and get into trouble. So it's great to be sober today and to have friends. My friend Andrew is here, and to have friends that accompany me and do things with me and that keep me from isolating and sitting alone with my problems. And I have worked this, haven't worked completely all 12 steps officially, but I've worked up through 8, and 9 is still kind of a sticking point for me. I don't know why, but maybe because one of my character defects is being a perfectionist, and I tend to think I need to make a list of every single person I ever want to make amends to, and some of those people are no longer living, or some of those people I can't find. So it's been sort of a hitch for me. But I do do the rest of the steps pretty much on a regular basis, and I have a meditation book that I use and try to say daily prayer, even if I'm not kneeling, and try to say a prayer every day and practice turning things over and letting things go and turning things over to my higher power. And can't think of too much else to say right now. I'm a little tired from walking all over and doing my sightseeing today, but it's great here to have the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'd encourage everybody to, at the end of the meeting, to thank Greg and learn a little bit more about him.